Hi, everybody. It's Derek, and this is your Foreign Exchanges World News Roundup for Saturday, April 20th and Sunday, April 21st, 2024. We've got a few anniversaries. On April 20th, 1752, a small battle south of the village at the time of Shwebo marked the start of the Konbaung-Hanthawaddy War, which helped to consolidate the modern state of Myanmar. An army, when I say army, it was around 40 men belonging to the nascent Konbaung dynasty under its founder Alang Paya, defeated a small military unit detached by the southern Hanthawaddy kingdom to pacify the region. The war ended with a Konbaung victory that reunited upper and lower northern and southern Myanmar, or Burma if you prefer, under a Bamar ruling family, and marked the final time that the Mon people of southern Myanmar tried to establish an independent state. On April 20th, 1792, the French Assembly declared war against the Habsburg monarchy, kicking off nearly 10 years of conflict, sometimes called the French Revolutionary Wars. This conflict is perhaps more properly broken down into the Wars of the First Coalition, 1792 to 1797, and the Second Coalition, the War of the Second Coalition, 1798 to 1802, referring to the international alliances that were arrayed against the French First Republic. The Republic emerged victorious from both wars. They are distinguished from the five subsequent wars, coalition wars, thanks to none other than our friend Napoleon. These took place between 1805 and 1815, who brought the Republic, of course, to an end when he was crowned emperor in 1804. On April 21st, 43 BCE, in the follow-up to the April 14th Battle of Forum Gallorum, Mark Antony's army was again defeated by a consular army led by Aulus Hirtius with the support of Octavian at the Battle of Mutina. Conveniently for Octavian, Hirtius died during the battle, and when his fellow consul Pansa died the following day of wounds suffered at Forum Gallorum, Octavian was left to claim sole credit for the victory. Questionable how much he actually had to do with it. The newly empowered Octavian soon turned on the Senate and later allied with Antony under the framework of the Second Triumvirate. On April 21st, 1526, an army led by a Timurid prince named Babur defeated the Lodi Sultanate, the army of the Lodi Sultanate, at Panipat. This was the first battle of Panipat. It laid the foundation for the Mughal dynasty. There's a piece about this battle up at the newsletter. Babur essentially was, as I say, a Timurid. He was a descendant of Tamerlane. He was very interested in sort of the family business, which was conquering Central Asia, but he was unsuccessful in several attempts to carve out an empire for himself or a kingdom for himself in Central Asia, mostly because of the Uzbeks. And so he turned his attention south, and he got some help from the Safavid dynasty in Iran, who helped him first kind of take on the Uzbeks. The Safavids were no fans of the Uzbeks. And then they helped him as he invaded India and dealt with the Lodi dynasty. He won this battle and really was able to drive the Lodi dynasty out of Delhi and establish his own dynasty, the Mughals. They did fall from power for a while under his successor, Humayun, who had to flee into Afghanistan and then seek help from the Iranian Safavids again to reclaim his kingdom. But for all intents and purposes, this first battle of Panipat is considered the foundation date of the Mughal dynasty. On April 21st in 1802, probably it might have been 1801, but probably 1802, a mob from what we would consider Saudi Arabia today, a Wahhabi mob under the rule of the Saud family, attacked the city of Karbala in modern-day Iraq. They sacked the Imam Hussein Shrine, which, of course, is the focus of the Karbala pilgrimage that Shia make annually. It was thus a fairly wealthy place, and so it was attractive, not just for religious reasons — the Wahhabis are famously intolerant of Shiism in general — but also because it was, had quite a bit of movable wealth, let's say, that could be carried off by the mob. Again, I have another piece about this up at the newsletter as well, if you want to read more about it. Moving on to the news in the Middle East and Israel-Palestine, there was an AP headline on Sunday that I think sums up where things stand. It reads, "Israeli strikes on southern Gaza city of Rafah kill 22, mostly children, as U.S. advances aid package." For clarification, mostly in this case means 18 out of those 22 deaths were children. I don't mean to single out this particular attack, which in its conduct and effect was indistinguishable from multiple Israeli attacks on Gaza every day. In full candor, when I saw that story, I was somewhat shocked at how desensitized I've become over the past 6 months to reading about, let's say, another 18 dead Palestinian children, most likely killed by weapons my government supplied. But that juxtaposition did catch my eye, in that this particular atrocity coincided with my government's decision to advance another $95 billion in mostly military aid to various U.S. clients around the world. That package includes some $17 billion in arms for Israel to enable the Israeli military, IDF, to kill more Palestinian kids, along with around $9 billion in humanitarian aid earmarked in part for those Palestinians who managed to survive the weapons. For all of the Biden administration's rhetoric about protecting Palestinian civilians, it seems the more kids the IDF kills, the more goodies we give it. We'll be returning to the military aid package later, because it's got other implications besides Gaza. But as for Israel-Palestine, there have been some other news items of note. The IDF's Friday morning raid, we talked about this in Friday's newsletter, on the Nur Shams refugee camp in the West Bank city of Tulkarm, continued through Saturday and left at least 14 people dead. At least some of them were members of the Tulkarm Brigade's militia, but the reporting I've seen doesn't make clear how many were combatants, and those figures may not be known. On Sunday, Israeli forces killed 3 Palestinians in 2 incidents. 2 allegedly attacked IDF personnel near the city of Hebron, while the 3rd was shot at the Hamra checkpoint for reasons that are not clear. In response to reports that U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has been suppressing evidence of Israeli human rights abuses in violation of the Leahy Law, we discussed this in Thursday's newsletter, the Biden administration used its favorite conduit, Axios's Barak Ravid, to leak word that the State Department will be imposing Leahy restrictions on a single IDF unit, the Netzah Yehuda Battalion, in the coming days. The Leahy Law has been around since the late 1990s, and it obliges the U.S. to cut off support for any military or law enforcement unit credibly accused of human rights violations. Netzah Yehuda has been accused of a wide array of crimes against Palestinians in the West Bank, to such an extent that even the Israeli government decided enough was enough and transferred it to the Golan in January 2023. Designating it under Leahy is more a symbolic than practical punishment, since the IDF can simply use its own funds to arm the battalion without direct U.S. support, and the U.S. probably can't track whether its weapons wind up in the hands of a Netzah Yehuda soldier anyway. But even the symbolism has generated some panicked reactions from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and War Cabinet member Benny Gantz, and the Times of Israel is reporting that other IDF units may be similarly designated in the near future. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition is reportedly organizing a humanitarian relief flotilla in Turkey that may set sail for Gaza in a matter of days. Anyone who recalls the 2010 Mavi Marmara incident, in which IDF commandos raided a Turkish aid ship and killed 10 people, will be familiar with the FFC. They'll be challenging the IDF's naval blockade again this time around. Organizers have implied that the flotilla was ready to sail on Sunday, but the Turkish government's squeamishness prevented its departure. In Syria, some enterprising folks fired at least 5 rockets from the vicinity of the northern Iraqi town of Zumar toward a U.S. military facility in northeastern Syria on Sunday. The truck used to fire those rockets subsequently blew up, but Iraqi authorities apparently can't say yet whether it was attacked by U.S. forces. Assuming the perpetrators were Iraqi militia fighters, which is at least a reasonable possibility, this would be the first time that cohort has attacked a U.S. military position since early February in the wake of their drone strike against U.S. personnel in Jordan. In Lebanon, according to Hezbollah, an Israeli airstrike killed 3 of that group's fighters in southern Lebanon on Saturday. Hezbollah officials say they attacked several IDF targets in northern Israel in response. Onto Asia, in Afghanistan, a sticky bomb killed 1 person and wounded 3 others on a minibus in the Kabul neighborhood of Kote Sangi on Saturday. Islamic State claimed responsibility to, I assume, no great surprise. In Pakistan, unspecified gunmen killed 2 Pakistani customs officers and wounded 3 more in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa province on Saturday evening. This was the second attack on customs personnel in that province the last few days. The previous incident left at least 4 people dead on Thursday. It's likely these attacks were carried out by the Pakistani Taliban or a related faction, though as far as I know, there hasn't been any claim of responsibility. In the Maldives, voters headed to the polls for their country's latest parliamentary election on Sunday and appear to have handed a victory to President Mohamed Mouiz's People's National Congress Party. The PNC is projected to take at least 62 of 93 seats in the next parliament, a supermajority that should give Mouiz a relatively free hand moving forward. Maldivian politics turn in part on the tug of war for influence between the Indian and Chinese governments. Mouiz and his party lean toward China, so this result will likely be good news for Beijing. In Myanmar, new fighting between rebels and Myanmar security forces near the town of Miawadi sent over 1,300 people fleeing across the border into Thailand over the weekend. Karen rebels and People's Defense Force fighters mostly seized control of Miawadi, a major commercial crossing point, earlier this month. On Saturday morning, they attacked a military position controlling a key bridge just west of the town. The rebels claim to have taken control of the bridge, which gives them full control of the border in that area. In North Korea, North Korean media reported over the weekend that the country's military had successfully tested a, quote, super large warhead, end quote, for its Hwasal-1 strategic cruise missile, along with a, quote, new type anti-aircraft missile, end quote. I'm certainly no expert in missile technology, but as far as I know, super large warhead is not a technical classification, and so I really can't tell you what it means, nor have I seen any analysis from people who do claim to be experts. It sounds big, though. Moving on to Africa, in Togo, the Togolese parliament on Friday approved for the second time a set of constitutional reforms that will weaken the power of the country's presidency in favor of a new prime minister-like position, while shifting the office from direct election to indirect election by parliament. The legislature had already approved these changes last month, but public outcry prompted President Faure Gnassingbé to call for a second vote. The Togolese opposition has warned that Gnassingbé intends to set himself up in the new PM or PM-like job, which will allow him to hold executive authority indefinitely without having to bother with legal formalities like term limits. In Niger, several outlets, including the AP, are confirming Friday's reports, we covered in Friday's newsletter, that the U.S. has acquiesced to the Nigerian military junta's demand for the withdrawal of U.S. military forces from that country. The AP, citing U.S. officials, as the Biden administration still hasn't publicly announced the withdrawal, reported on Saturday that there's no timetable yet for the redeployment and that, quote, an American delegation to coordinate the details of the withdrawal process will be dispatched soon, end quote. There is as yet no indication how the Pentagon intends to replace Niger, which was the hub for its West African operations. Apparently, there's some hope that the junta is just going through some sort of phase and that it might still be possible for U.S. forces to return to Niger down the road. In Europe, in Ukraine, the Russian military says its forces seized the village of Bohdanivka on Sunday. There's been no confirmation from Ukrainian officials, but what independent reporting there is from the area seems to support the Russian claim. Bohdanivka is just northeast of Chasiv Yar, the town that has been the focus of Russia's advance for several weeks now. As you might expect, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky was pretty pleased to learn that the U.S. House of Representatives approved roughly $61 billion in new aid for his government, most of it military aid, on Saturday. In an interview with NBC News on Sunday, he urged the rapid shipment of new arms once the aid package is finally signed into law, stressing in particular a need for air defenses and long-range weapons. The Washington Post reported on Friday that the Pentagon has already put together an initial package of arms that should be ready to go in short order. We mentioned this in Friday's newsletter. In Kosovo, the Kosovan government's attempt to unwind the tension caused by last year's controversial local elections in four predominantly Serb communities has been a bust. Let me read you a bit of this piece from the AP. Residents of four Serb-majority municipalities on Sunday overwhelmingly boycotted a vote on removing their ethnic Albanian mayors from office following last year's mayoral elections. The referendum, supported by the West, was an attempt to defuse tensions between Kosovo and neighboring Serbia as both countries vied to join the European Union. However, Kosovo's main Serb party, Srpska Lista or Serbian List, which has close ties with Belgrade, had called for a boycott of Sunday's poll. Only 253 out of 46,556 registered voters cast their ballots in all four municipalities. For the mayors to be ousted, a majority vote is needed. No ballots at all were cast in one of the municipalities, Zvezdan, according to results after voting ended at 1700 Greenwich Mean Time. That quote, that is why we note that the citizens' initiative to oust the mayors of the municipalities of Leposavić, Zubin Potok, Zvečan, and North Mitrovica has failed, said Kresnik Radoniki, head of the Central Election Commission, which is in charge of the process. Kosovan officials are accusing the Serbian government of ordering the boycott. A Serbian list says that it wants the mayors out, but it is demanding their resignation rather than going through this referendum process. In the Americas, in Ecuador, voters there headed to the polls on Sunday for a referendum of their own on President Daniel Noboa's security crackdown. Among the issues on the ballot is Noboa's decision to declare gang violence and, quote, internal armed conflict, end quote, in order to deploy military forces in a law enforcement role. Results were not yet available at time of recording. In Venezuela, opposition parties have aligned behind a new candidate to challenge President Nicolas Maduro in July's election, a former diplomat named Edmundo Gonzalez. The parties had provisionally registered him as their candidate in March, but had to come to a final decision before a procedural deadline on Saturday. Gonzalez replaces Maria Corina Machado, who won the joint opposition primary in October, but remains legally prohibited from running for office. In Mexico, Mexican politics has been marred by violence in the run-up to the country's June 2nd general election. Mayoral candidates in Tamaulipas and Oaxaca states were found dead on Saturday, and they thus become the 16th and 17th Mexican political candidates murdered in this election cycle. Out-of-control criminal violence is surely to blame. The Mexican government has started providing security for some candidates, but it's been slow to roll that program out to candidates for local municipal offices. And finally, in the United States, Undiplomatic's Van Jackson has issues with the Biden administration's new metaphor for its Asia-Pacific strategy as a lattice fence of alliances. Let me read you a bit of his piece. Perhaps you think I should give the administration some credit for wanting to distance themselves from the imperial-flavored imaginary of Asia that policymakers have embraced my entire adult life, an American hub and alliances as spokes. Washington's professed rationale for the metaphor change is to characterize the region in a way that accounts for the many networks of trilateral, bilateral, and quadrilateral ties that crisscross the region. On a superficial level, that may seem fine, but I have two issues with this. One, what most Asian security folks know but do not acknowledge is that intra-Asian ties have always been a thing. It's not some new invention that Uncle Sugar came up with. What's new the past decade or so is that the U.S. has spent an inordinate amount of diplomatic capital trying to encourage many networks of allies to develop the same threat perceptions and to be militarily interoperable. They seek a kind of intellectually monolithic Voltron that at its best might give the U.S. the benefits of an Asian NATO alliance without the commitment slash constraints of one. I was once part of that project, and I made my early academic career writing about it from a non-critical perspective. Two, policy practitioners and scholars who focus on Asia like to talk about regional architecture, which is shorthand for the structures that order regional relations, be they institutions, regimes, power, whatever. But I've studied this shit for my entire adult life just as they have. The thinking that dominates when it comes to regional architecture is not rigorous enough. Unless you can make meaningful or causal claims about why particular configurations of architecture matter, you really ain't saying nothing. And that's the problem here. The lattice fence metaphor has no value as a way to understand Asia or the Pacific. That's all for us this weekend. I hope you had a good one. Thanks to all of you for reading and or listening to the newsletter, and especially those of you who are Foreign Exchanges subscribers making this newsletter possible. Until next time, take care, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.